Good evening, April 8th, 2010. James McCanny with my Science Hour going right into the show. Earthquakes seem to be the ticket for this week. And many of the other earthquakes around the world not even making the news because of the activity right here in our own backyard. So I'll be talking about that. But the main science topic tonight, I will be talking about something I don't think anybody has ever breached the topic before, but could we have a beneficial Planet X encounter? That sounds rather strange. We all think of Planet X, ultimate destruction, that the world would end, everything, we would all die, and maybe there'd be a few survivors. We'd be sitting here with our water filters and attempting to eke out a living on a totally destroyed planet. That's not necessarily the case. I've given lectures before about the various factors and the relative to, say, a near-close encounter with a large celestial object coming through the solar system. These are all hypothetical cases. And as distance between Earth and the object becomes greater, then the effects become less. The electrical effects, the water, the flooding, the hydrocarbon deluge, the burning naphtha, the rain of rocks that would come in from the comet environment. This is a large comet, not little powder puff comets like Halley's Comet. And so the kind of comets that they talk about in ancient texts, not the little powder puff comets we've seen of late, or even Hale-Bopp, which may have been a somewhat medium-sized comet, but not big, not sky-to-sky, wall-to-wall, raging type of comet. So in that respect, Hale-Bopp was pretty mild and meek. But at any rate, the main science topic, could we have a beneficial Planet X encounter? And I'll get into that. Okay, on to the topic of earthquakes. Now, I'm going to talk more in general about earthquakes because you've all been able to read the news, look at the U.S. Geological Survey site maps with all of the recurring aftershocks and the devastation in certain locales where the main earthquakes have occurred. For example, a lot of people probably are not aware that Chile this past week had a series of earthquakes, significant earthquakes offshore, just like the previous ones. Remember the tsunami heading off to the Hawaiian Islands? Well, that happened again this past week, but a lot of people here are not aware of that. And then also Malaysia always having earthquakes, that ring of fire running around the Pacific, always a likely candidate for activity. But the interesting part about the early California earthquakes this past week was that they were not on a known fault line. They were not on the main fault line, San Andreas Fault, that basically runs from the tip of South America all the way up to Alaska and around the Aleutian Island chain. That's a very long, that's a very long earth circling fault line. So I'll be talking a little bit in general about earthquakes. First of all, if you would like to go to a real good source, of course, the U.S. Geological Survey, it's called, let me give you the website, there's no www on this, so if in doubt, just type in one of your search engines, earthquake USGS gov, and that will bring you to the U.S. Geological Survey site. Or if you can remember this, http://earthquake.usgs.gov, and start clicking around and you'll get to all of the maps, etc., that show you the aftershocks, the location of the main earthquake, the depth of the main earthquake, and all the data relative to recent earthquakes. And you also have a world map which tells you all about the world, the entire world. So at any rate, the point is, that there's a lot of data, good data, specific data, not interpreted data, let's put it that way. These are just, this is raw data regarding earthquakes and aftershocks, and you can see where they are in the numbers. And of course, the startling thing about the California earthquakes was the number of aftershocks, hundreds of them, within just hours. And then, of course, leading up to everything that's happened over the past week. Though, but there are many people, of course, that are going to ask the question, are these earthquakes man-made? Or are they triggered? Are the first big ones man-made and that triggers all of the subsequent ones? And the real answer is, or there's might be another way of asking that question, can you tell the difference between a man-made earthquake and a naturally occurring earthquake? And the answer is that really we don't know. I mean, as lay people out here, there's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of people who will just say things to garner attention. But the main, the reality is we don't really have data, scientific data, that would tell us, yes, this was a man-made one, or no, this was not a man-made earthquake. We really don't have any way of telling, but I'll go into a little bit of detail on how one might cause an earthquake. A couple of the known techniques, one of them being due to Tesla technology. The first one would be to simply drill a hole just like you drill with, say, an oil rig, where they can go down miles to find oil reserves. And instead of sending a pipe down that would be used to draw out oil, they would send down a nuclear charge and set it off right at a specific location and maybe set up a series of these. So that, for example, let's take a building, a demolition building. Let's say, good example, the 911 towers. What a great example. But at any rate, if you're going to demolish something that's under stress, the building is under gravitational stress, the gravity is pulling down on it, and it wants to fall down, but of course the structure holds it up. So how would you bring this down in a controlled manner? Well, you would put explosives at all of the key locations, the girders, the support system, and then at just exactly the right time, you would blow them so that the building would begin to fall in a controlled manner, therefore falling down and, in fact, each floor falling on the next one perfectly so it comes down exactly at the base footprint. So now, can you tell the difference between a demolished building and a demolished building that was a controlled demolition and a building that just decides to fall down someplace, or maybe an airplane hits it? Who knows? But can you tell the difference? And the answer is absolutely. There's a huge difference between what you might call a accidental cause of failure of the structure and a controlled demolition. And there's certainly no question about the 911 towers that they were absolutely controlled demolition. It's just, to see it any other way is pretty ludicrous. But, of course, that's the Gov story that they want to pass on to you. But the question referring to earthquakes, are earthquakes controlled? And if they are, how would you tell? Well, if somebody's drilling down and putting a nuclear charge, 20 miles down, that might be very difficult to detect. One of the possibilities is that you would actually detect the explosion on an earthquake seismometer. Those are the delicate instruments that measure earthquakes. And basically, it's a needle going back and forth on a piece of paper that's a drum. And now they are more electronic. Back in the old days, they actually had a sheet of paper that rolled off of a drum, and the needle would go up and down based on the movement of the earth. Now, I just want to give an example. A lot of people are, it's not clear that the earth itself is very flexible and pliable. It's a transmission medium for sound and waves. So basically, here's what happens. The vibrations occur in the earth, and they can be lateral or vertical. There are different types of transmitted waves, and so they could be vertical, meaning like kind of like an ocean wave, where a boat passes by, or they could be lateral, kind of like a sound wave. So if you're listening to my voice coming off of a speaker, which most of you are right now, then that voice wave, that sound wave, is coming laterally at you. So there are different kinds of waves, and they feel different if you're in an earthquake zone, the type of wave that would be passing by you. So at any rate, the question coming back to, could you detect a nuclear explosion? And the answer is yes. If you took a seismometer reading and you first saw this explosion and then you saw in the same region, coming from the same region, and this is done by triangulation. In other words, you have seismometers they're placed around an area, and then they detect the amount of time that it takes to get to their location, and by doing that, they can determine exactly where the earthquake was, and by estimating travel time within the ground, and they can also estimate depth of the earthquake. So if you could locate, for example, an explosion, and then determine its signature on the seismometer, then you could determine potentially that was man-made. But how do you tell the difference between a nuclear explosion and the initial shock of a large earthquake? Well, if there were two signatures very close together, first the explosion and then the shock wave that comes from the actual earthquake, and I might point out, too, that this happened with the Muir building in Oklahoma City. There were seismometers on campus and in the area to measure earthquakes, and they showed that there were explosions just prior to the building falling. So they could actually measure the building falling and the explosions that preceded it. And they also noted, I believe, that there were two explosions, which kind of defies the one bomber in front with a ammonia nitrate bomb. Is that what it was? The like from Farmer, you know, the type that farmers used to blow stumps out of the ground with. But at any rate, that's not the point here. The other type of causation or man-made cause of earthquakes is that the a type of Tesla technology. Any system has a resonant frequency, a drum, a guitar. Let's take a guitar string. That's a linear, one-dimensional vibrational system. And if you pluck a guitar string, it will vibrate at a certain tone or note, and then it has overtones, as they are called, higher frequency vibrations, and a good ear, a good trained ear of a musician or somebody tuning a guitar or a technician, a musical technician, can hear those overtones. And so they are in harmony, so to speak, with the original tone. And that's where a lot of our understanding of harmony comes from. It's a very natural phenomena. It's related to the original notes and vibrational frequencies. And so if you stroke a guitar string repeatedly, you'll get the same note. So that's the point, is that you have a vibrational frequency, a very set vibrational frequency on a guitar string. On a drum head, the same thing, but a drum head is two-dimensional. So the waves that are set up in that drum head are quite a bit different. And the equations that govern these patterns, these wave patterns, are very different. So the point is that earthquakes have very set patterns or vibrational frequencies. And the ground has a certain vibrational frequency because it's a transmitter of energy, and energy can be transmitted via waves, sound waves or acoustical waves or electrical waves also. So the point is that if you could take some kind of a transmitter or an electrical device and start repeatedly introducing energy into the system at a resonant frequency, the resonant frequency of the ground, and then focus that on a given area, you could potentially start to create earthquakes. And here's how it works. Actually, there's a great example in the Bible of the, I believe it was the city of Jericho. And the opposing army came in, and the walls of Jericho were very stout and sturdy, as legend had it. And so the opposing army started to march around the city, all in cadence, boom, boom, all marching at the same cadence. And the rhythm, the energy from all of those feet started to build up and create a resonance. And every time the foot would hit the ground, it would add energy to the system. It would not only add energy to the system, but it would add it at a very set frequency. And so eventually the walls of Jericho came tumbling down because of the repeated infrequency steps of the soldiers marching around the city. So at any rate, that's the type of effect small amounts of energy can have if they're put in at the right frequency. So at any rate, that's the type of remote activity that could be used to generate energy that could create an earthquake. One might ask, too, why are there so many aftershocks? And this is rather common. What's going on under the ground is the ground is readjusting. Once a big earthquake occurs, there's a slippage in plates. Things adjust, and they basically have movement underground. Well, if something gives here, something's going to have to give over there, and that's basically what's happening. So the area down by in Baja, just as we cross over into the Mexican border this past week, for example, there were earthquakes, hundreds of earthquakes, aftershocks that occurred after the main incident. And so why so many? The earth is adjusting. It's trying to get back to normal. And now I was somewhat surprised that the effects were not felt all the way up the, say, all the way up to Alaska sooner because of the extreme number of small aftershocks that occurred. So there was a lot of adjusting going on down in the Baja California area. And I know people out in that Los Angeles down to San Diego area, and of course they all felt this. So it's interesting to see that they would feel those early aftershocks after the very first initial earthquakes is what I'm talking about. Could earthquakes result from solar activity? And of course, this is a topic that I did a lot of work on and talked about, and I have a permanent posting on my webpage because every time there's an earthquake, there's some people that go running out and jumping up and down saying, oh, it was caused by the sun or solar sunspots or some such. And is that true? Well, no, not really. Not all earthquakes are caused by sunspots or other types of solar activity. It's actually quite rare because we have hundreds of earthquakes occurring on Earth every day of the year, all year long. And so is the sun out there thumping the earth, so to speak, to cause all these earthquakes? The answer is a definitive no. But can earthquakes be caused by solar activity? Well, it can add to the scenario. It's not going to go down and create all the energy that would occur in an earthquake. The earthquake is actually dispelling or releasing energy that is already pent up. Two plates are grabbed against each other. There's a lot of pressure. One wants to move one way. The other one wants to move the other way. But there's a lot of pressure there. So if you could somehow create a trigger to start that moving, then it's going to move. And so that's kind of the trick. We call these trigger mechanisms. And there's many in nature where there are pent-up sources of energy, and all of a sudden something can trigger the release of that energy. Hurricanes are the same. If you look at my weather book, the issue of how hurricanes form and the sources of energy, the hurricanes are actually driven by electrical currents from the ionosphere. And that's part of my science work, my weather book, showing that hurricanes are in fact driven by electrical conditions that actually originate outside the atmosphere. Okay, but how are these energy sources triggered? Well, a cloud system moves off of Africa. That big cloud system is reaching up towards the upper atmosphere and starts a small trickle of electrical current. Then that leads to a bigger electrical current, and all of a sudden you have a cascade of energy coming down, which causes a hurricane. So at any rate, the earthquakes are somewhat the same. In fact, it's interesting to note that hurricanes and earthquakes go hand in hand many times. There's many examples of major earthquakes occurring as hurricanes moved onshore. These occur many times in Japan and China. We've seen this repeatedly where hurricanes, major hurricanes, are coming onshore only to be associated with a fairly significant earthquake. There was a hurricane that that approached the Hawaiian Islands a couple years ago, and I remember this very well. The hurricane came up from the east, as they always do, coming from California. It swung up towards the southern, southeastern sector of the island of Hawaii, what they call the Big Island. And all of a sudden, that hurricane shorted out to a small island that's developing offshore, off the southeast corner of the island of Hawaii. And within minutes, there was a fairly significant, I think it was about a 4.5 earthquake, about 10 miles down. Well, gee, how does that work? How does a hurricane cause an earthquake? Well, what happens is that electrical energy is coming from the ionosphere. It's driving that massive hurricane storm system, and all of a sudden it shorts out to land. And the end result is that electrical energy has to go somewhere. It follows crevices, mineral deposits, and water veins down deep into the earth until it hits some blockage area, in which case that would be a fault line, or possibly in the case of Hawaii, a volcanic vent. And there you go, an earthquake caused by a hurricane. Very strange combination, but of course in standard science, there's no reference to any association, because there's no reason to believe. There's, in the standard story of hurricanes, hurricanes are caused by warm water. Well, there's no reason to believe that warm water is going to cause an earthquake. So there is no logical association within standard science. But if you look at real science, the fact that, like I say, I've shown that hurricanes are caused by electrical currents from the ionosphere, now you have a significant power source and the mechanism to deliver it to the location, which is the deep crevice or the deep fault line zone in the earth, and all of a sudden you have an earthquake. So, at any rate, this is kind of a general discussion of earthquakes, not referring in general, or not referring specifically to the earthquake activity of this past week. But as I said, go to the U.S. Geological Survey website and you can see all of the diagrams and data for earthquakes, aftershocks, location, depth of the earthquake, type of earthquake, the damage reports, etc. And it's very interesting to see that the location. You can also go in and see historically where the earthquakes have occurred. and there are places where earthquakes have never occurred. But this is an interesting thing also. I did a little study one time looking at earthquakes, and looking at the places where they've never occurred, trying to find evidence of, what we call moraines. Moraine is in geology. It's an area that just doesn't fit. It's, an area that developed under the ocean, but it's in the middle of a continent where there is no ocean. That's a moraine. So it's very interesting to see that there are many areas of the Earth where there have been no historical earthquakes or earthquake activity, but all of a sudden you have a location that could only have been caused by an earthquake. It's very interesting. So remember that the maps that we see of earthquake locations, this is all current activity, measured activity from seismometers that have been used since, you know, in the past 100 years, let's say, where the earthquakes have been recorded. So a very short time geologically where the earthquakes have been recorded and placed on a map. Okay, on to the next. I'm sorry, there's actually one final comment that I need to make here. And one might ask, why so many earthquakes? There's really another answer to that, in that Earth experienced a vast cometary encounter. It was a very jarring event for Earth. Volcanic activity, the end of an era for many animals and Earth dwellers. We had a near mass extinction or a partial mass extinction. The mastodons, the saber-toothed tigers, all went under at that same time. And it was all at the same time as the Venus encounter, when Venus the comet came through the solar system, working its way into the location where we see it today. But that also, that event, in addition to being the cause of the Great Flood, the biblical encounters of fire and naphtha, etc., you know, recounted by Moses, the Noah's Ark scenario, all of these things happening during that encounter. But geologically, it really shook up the Earth. It moved plates, it jarred things, and so Earth is right now still recovering from that era. It's recovering and adjusting. So that's why we have so many earthquakes. We would not have this level of earthquake activity or volcanic activity if it were not for that event. If the Earth were 4.5 billion years old, as standard science wants to portray, we wouldn't have all of this earthquake activity. That would have been settled out ages and ages ago, long, long, long ago. And so the fact that we do have an active Earth, active volcanoes, active earthquakes, active fault lines, a lot of movement, that's just more proof that somewhere in recent history, Earth has experienced, in fact, a jarring event. Let's just put it that way. And, of course, before I talked about these kind of events where a big object would come by, and how does it affect Earth? Well, it's a gravitational wave, basically. This object is coming by at a fairly high speed, so a wave of its gravity basically grabs onto Earth, and if anything's not nailed down, it's going to move. There's going to be a wave involved. And so a good example is the lunar tide. Every day we experience a lunar tide, a wave that goes around the Earth as the Earth spins under the moon. And so this is something that everybody can understand, that the tide caused by the moon is a daily event because the moon is right here. It's always right here. So as the Earth moves underneath or spins underneath the moon pulls out the edge of the Earth or the closest point of the Earth to the moon, and it pulls out. So that causes a bulge in the Earth's ocean. It also pulls out on the landmass. A lot of people don't realize that we have about an inch tide in the Earth's surface. It actually moves up and then drops back down about an inch every time we pass under the moon. And so that's a gradual rise and a gradual fall as the Earth spins under the moon in its daily pattern of spinning once every 24 hours. So the moon actually causes a wave. Now imagine a much bigger object coming by at a much higher speed. It's going to cause a big wave, a big tidal wave in both the ocean and in the land. Now if you have what happens to waves? Well, they continue to move. They move. And so if you have a tidal wave in the land, and it's moving and it's maybe, say, 2-3 feet high, all of a sudden that tidal wave is going to move rapidly in a certain direction, and it's going to keep doing that until it hits a belt of resistance, which typically would be a mountain range or a major deposit, say an iron deposit in the ground, some major, deposit of some type of rock or it would be there. And so therefore you would have a way to stop or absorb the energy in that wave. And that's how mountains are built. They absorb these tremendous gravitational waves that come through the Earth. That energy hits the mountain range that's already there and then continues to build more mountains in the same region. So you can see, for example, any mountain range has multiple epochs of mountain building. And you look at any mountain range in the world and go observe this phenomenon in the rock, in the structure of the mountains. For example, the southern Colorado Rocky Mountains are a great example of many, many different epochs of mountain building. And so the point is that earthquakes are a part of this whole process because everything's readjusting, and once the big wave gets done moving through, now everything has to readjust and accommodate the fact that the Earth has been moved and jarred, and really a tremendous amount of energy has been put into the Earth. That all happening, the point is that the Earth is a very active place. It's not a stagnant old 4.5 billion year old place. So at any rate, the point is we have a lot of active earthquake regions on Earth. There's a reason for that, and the real reason is because Earth has had a recent, very jarring event in recent history. Now, recent history in geological terms could have been a million years ago. But in this case, it was within probably 10,000 years, probably sooner. Okay, on to the next brief topic here. This has been in the news for a while, and I've just kind of ignored it because it's so silly and ridiculous. But it keeps popping up, so I thought at least I'll make comment that automobiles being affected by cosmic rays. Now, a cosmic ray is a high-energy proton coming through outer space, usually relativistic speed. So this thing was generated in this velocity of this proton was generated in a tremendously energetic interaction. So cosmic rays can cause damage. They can cause damage in electronics. If they hit you, they can cause damage. So cosmic rays are not good for certain, you know, for physical items, for physical objects. Now, car manufacturers, and this started out with Toyota, with the recall, and somebody got the bright idea to claim that, oh, all of these problems are caused by cosmic rays. And I thought, oh, my goodness, could this possibly be true? Could anybody be ludicrous enough to think that people would bite off on this? Yet it gets into the national news. So now everybody's saying, cosmic rays cause car problems. And it's so ridiculous because you have a consistent problem. That would mean that every car got hit exactly in the same way with a cosmic ray, which is absolutely absurd. And why didn't the other cars over there get affected? Why just Toyotas? Well, these must be some of those Toyota-specific cosmic rays they hunt and find those Toyota cars, and they hit those. They hit the little chips, sensor chips, in the Toyota cars only. So how absolutely ridiculous to imagine that such a thing could happen or would actually exist. But it's making the news, and so I thought I'd at least make a brief commentary. If somebody tells you that cosmic rays are causing car failures, I don't think so. I don't think so. Well, how about let's just say everything that fails is caused by a cosmic ray? Because how are you going to prove it? The proton's gone. You don't have a gaping hole in the product, in the item. You don't have any way of really detecting or proving it. So who's going to say you're wrong? And so there again, if you were looking at true science would say, okay, if you're going to claim that cosmic rays are causing your car problems, then you have to have a battery of tests that can prove this. Just absolute absurdity out there. But, of course, science has gone by the wayside in this country and the entire world. The real true nature of science, based on repeatable evidence and experimentation, it just doesn't happen out there anymore. Okay, so on to the main science topic. And this is a good one, given the earthquake activity of this past week. The question being, main science topic, could a Planet X passage type of scenario save the world? And most of us, when we think of Planet X, we think of devastation. We think of complete Earth devastation, mass extinction, Velikovsky type scenario where it's just completely destroyed. Everything is totaled. And there might be a few survivors that are just trying to eke out a living, and the survival conditions are horrendous, and somehow the human race is regenerated again. And actually, that's what is talked about in the Colburn, the initial pages of the Colburn. The fact that man had been reborn because of a devastating event, and they're very specific that it's the comets. They don't say comets. They talk about the dragons in the sky and other figurative speeches, but it's very clear they're talking about comets that presented the characteristics of comets, including the rain of naphtha, burning naphtha rocks, the devastation of Earth, the volcanoes, the belching of Earth of gases. It was just not a fun place to be at the time, believe me, if you read those accounts in the Colburn and in the Old Testament. So, would all Planet X encounters be of that magnitude? And the answer is no, because as an object comes by Earth, and this has happened many times in the past, it will happen again in the future, but I don't know when, I don't have a date, so don't try and quote me on that. But these large objects coming through the solar system have electrical effects, gravitational effects, and then they're surrounded by a shroud of material, gaseous material, water, hydrocarbons, other types of material. And so the point is that a Planet X type encounter could be absolutely devastating, but if the object passed by at a significant distance, there could be still significant damage to Earth, but not enough to just kill everybody off. Now let's imagine a scenario in which a Planet X type object, and of course this is in the form of a large comet, remember that, that is the primary thing to remember. This is not a big round orange object that you would see in the sky. It's a comet. So if this comet came close enough to where it actually could do damage, but not so close where it absolutely destroys everything, the question is, could such a Planet X type encounter save the world? And what do I mean by save the world? Well, what if we could get rid of all of the people that don't do anything, that are in cities, that are bankers, I have friends that are bankers, so don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to suggest that all bankers die, but the banking system could collapse because of infrastructure, just the simple lack of infrastructure. So the point is, could we have a Planet X scenario which would affect the entire Earth, not just some of the big cities in the U.S., but the entire Earth would be just shaken to the point, earthquakes, electrical activity knocking out the grid systems to the point where they couldn't be repaired, which would take down all of the other systems like fuel, which depends heavily on electricity, water and the distribution of water, which depends heavily on electricity. So if all of the infrastructure were knocked out and, say, major bridges were knocked down, so transportation was not easily facilitated, factories, production, manufacturing, just the basic daily lifestyle of people would be taken down completely, taken down to the ground completely. So the point is, could this happen, then all of a sudden people are left on their own. They're left with complete inability to go, say, to the grocery store, or go down and get gasoline, to do anything that they would normally do. So now we are at somewhat of what you might call a survival mode. Survival mode where you would be... Excuse me. The issue with a minor, let's call it a minor earth destruction, the destruction of infrastructure, then things like banking don't work anymore. Government doesn't work. Government does not have the ability to do all of the things it needs to do to reach out to the people. You couldn't vote. Just think of everything that uses electricity. It's just everything would shut down. So now we go back to somewhat of a primitive society where everything you eat and all of the services you have, everything, all the clothes you have, everything you have is going to come from a radius of maybe 1 mile around you. Everything, especially your food, your necessities, your water, everything is going to be right there. And if you're able to live off of that area, you're going to do just fine. Some people might have a bigger area if they're out already in the country. So what would this do to the cities? Well, the cities could not function because everything, all of the supplies for the people have to be shipped into the city. Nobody has the ability to grow food, certainly not enough to eat on a daily and ongoing basis. Water distribution, transportation, your ability to elimination of waste, whether it's human waste or garbage or byproducts of food, etc. All of this has to be cycled, and it's a very intricate system that allows the city to exist. So the cities would simply cease to exist. If people could get out of the city, that would be something. But in a case like this, remember Haiti, it was the people were trying to walk into the countryside. And after a devastating earthquake like that, it was hard to even know where to walk. Nothing looked the same. How do you go out to the countryside when all the buildings are down and everything's topsy-turvy? It's a difficult scenario to live through, but here's the end result. The Earth would go back into a mode, and would this be the best of both worlds, where the infrastructure was completely devastated? Well, I'm not suggesting this is a great idea. I don't really think it's a great idea, but it would be a method of eliminating a lot of the problems that Earth is faced with right now. The governments, the wars, the banking, all of the very, very intrusive activity of government on personal lives. People would be basically set back to a very rural type of existence, and only the people, and say that you could only get to 1 or 2 miles. That was the absolute distance that you could walk or maneuver. Then people are going to be stuck right where they are right now. So imagine, you know, wherever you are, you're listening to this show right now, imagine that that was it. That was where you're going to be. That is where you're going to be forever, till you finally die someday. Are you going to exist in a prosperous manner? Are you going to be well off? Was everything going to be just fine? Or are you going to have some problems? Are you able to supply for yourself? Are you able to eat? Do you have enough food for immediate use? Or do you have a way to get clean water? Or are you just completely out of it? You have no ability to do any of those. And then in the long term, grow your own food, provide, you know, a healthy diet for you and your family. That's a tall, tall order, especially for people who've never done that, that have never had any experience taking care of themselves. That's a pretty incredible demand that would be put on people or groups of people. I've often been on radio shows as guests or on my own where I talk about survival or the type of things that would happen in a survival scenario. And I often try and use the example of people that are out there right now, people that are out there already trying to live off their land, and very few people actually do. Very few people are autonomous, can do everything themselves, are able to grow their own food, and never have to go into town for anything. This guy was telling me one time that he asked his uncle, who had a farm or a ranch in Texas, what it was like during the Great Depression. And the uncle said, what depression? In other words, they didn't depend on the economy for their livelihood, so it didn't affect them. It had nothing to do with them because they were autonomous. They were already autonomous. So there's a group of people, and as I travel around too, I see areas, and I always think, you know, these people, and you see them there, and they're very poor. They're out there digging fence posts by hand and putting up fencing by hand, all of this handwork, and you think, wow, those people are poor. You know that their annual income is very low. But basically, they don't go to town for food. The food that they eat comes right from where they are, everything they get. They might buy a bag of rice, or they might buy some other things, but say in the tropics, their fruit, their vegetables, everything they eat, the meat, maybe fish, just about everything they have comes from right there. And they're living in a very primitive way, but if a major event happened, like a infrastructure downfall due to a bypassing Planet X type object, where it wasn't complete devastation, but just devastation of the infrastructure, the roads, the electricity, the water distribution, those people wouldn't know the difference. The next day, they would be up and running again. Then, you know, you might have some severe flooding for a few days, or you may have other things. You may have viruses that come in that are due to the comet. As we pass through the comet tail, we pick up viruses that had been built in that comet tail environment, etc. But basically, after a few days, they would be back to normal, and they probably would have no idea that the rest of the world had been destroyed in terms of infrastructure, that the cities no longer existed. They probably have no idea what a city is even like. No clue. We take it for granted that people everywhere would know about highways and freeways and how to get places, or in the northern climates, how to drive in the snow. A lot of these people have never seen snow. They've never seen a freeway system. They've never seen the nice new cars all, you know, in a row driving up and down the freeways. You know, millions of them a day passing through these cities with nice buildings, with nice, heated or air-conditioned buildings. They have no idea. They have absolutely no idea that such things exist. They've just heard about them, but in their mind's eye, they really can't envision it. These are the people, what I call I'm just quoting from the past, the meek of the earth. These are, as said too, the meek of the earth will inherit the earth. Now, that's an interesting concept because these are the people I'm talking about, the people who are just the poor people. They have no real wealth, so to speak, in earthly terms. They have no wealth, but they will inherit the earth. In other words, the entire earth will go asunder, the population of the earth. And the only people left over, the only people that have a chance of survival, are those people that simply are out there, probably due to their birthright, due to the fact they were simply born into that area. And, everything they're doing now, they would just continue to do. Saving their seeds, planting crops, chickens and other type of animals running around the farm or the farmhouse. Very impoverished conditions, very stringent conditions on the young people as far as health, as far as there's no shots or things like that. Not that they're good. But these are people that live on the earth. They're living with the earth, and they are kind of one with the earth. They can drink the water. They can, they're adapted to their environment. And they don't need a lot of support system. Everything they do is right there. And if they had to replace some metal tools with some handmade tools of wood or other types of materials, they could do that, and it wouldn't be as efficient as having metal tools, which they apparently can get now, but still, they would be able to continue. And, for example, they wouldn't have to put up fences because there wouldn't be any reason to. There's no reason to keep the animals in or out because they're just there. Back to the main idea, Planet X doesn't necessarily mean absolute devastation. In fact, the probability that an object coming through the solar system would really devastate Earth is actually pretty small. It's a big place out there, and Earth is in an orbit. A great example is Hale-Bopp. Back in the 90s, when Hale-Bopp was coming through, it was originally on a trajectory, on an orbit, to have a very near collision with Earth. But it slowed down in its orbit, and Earth moved ahead in its orbit, and so we were a full 90 degrees around the Sun when Hale-Bopp came through about a million miles off of Earth's orbit. So if we had been a simple 3 months earlier in our orbit, we could have had a very nice comet encounter, proving all of the theoretical work that I've done with the plasma discharge comet model, etc., proving it to everybody. But it wouldn't have been fun, because why prove it when it would have been so devastating to Earth? We would have gone through that comet coma. We would have lost heat content on Earth. We would have had a pretty good flood scenario because of the water coming in. Electrical discharges, because we would have been on the nose side, the sunward side of the comet nucleus. It would have been a pretty big disaster on an Earth-wide scale. This is Hale-Bopp, talking about Hale-Bopp back in the 1990s. But that didn't happen. And that didn't happen because the conditions weren't right. So it's very unusual. Very, very unusual for any of the planets to have a major, major encounter with another celestial object. Just because the chance, if something comes in, there's no guarantee. Say that we see some object coming into the solar system, it's big, it's raging comet, there's no guarantee that it'll even come close to Earth. It might affect the sun, and then the sun would kick out a lot of energy and affect our weather. But the comet directly affecting us might be almost pretty minimal. The other thing is that the planets sheathe themselves or protect themselves electrically and magnetically by forming a sheath. That's what an Earth-wide magnetic field is all about. It's a protection. It's a balancing. It's a in a sense, a negating of the magnetic field to be seen all around it, or the electric field. These are shielding events, and it goes on all the time in outer space, where an object is simply shielded from its environment, either electrically or magnetically or both. But the point is that an object coming into the solar system does not necessarily mean doom for Earth or any other planet. You just have to take it on a case-by-case basis. You have to understand what objects might cause damaging conditions. And, of course, the great big ones, the big ones, the Jupiter-sized ones, which there must be out there, are going to cause some severe damage whether they come close or not. So it all depends on how close this object, and with its comet tail, it all depends on how close it comes to Earth, the level of damage that would be incurred. So back to the original question, could a Planet X encounter, type of encounter with an unknown, unnamed object coming in from outside the solar system, could it cause beneficial effects for the human race? And in a sense, there is a yes-no answer, as with many answers. It's going to be devastating for most people, but it would get us back to a garden situation, an Adam and Eve-type garden situation, where we would be, potentially, we would have all of the, let's say, garbage in our life, from government, banking, and all of the other related issues would simply be gone, because we'd be back to an agrarian lifestyle. Now, last couple of minutes, I'm just going to mention, I think I forgot to give the mail order address last week. And so here it is for those people that like to use mail order, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. The website, JMCC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com. Go there. All the information is there. There's about 3.7 gigabytes of information on the webpage now, so enough to keep most people busy for quite a while if you're serious about studying this material. And all of the related issues around it, that is as complicated as the science itself. But what can you buy at the website or at that mail order address? Just quickly, the Dalton, the Dalton stainless steel water filter, $289, free shipping to the U.S., and add $21 to Canada, $41 to all other countries shipping. But basically, it's a water filter that you will use on a daily basis for cooking in your kitchen, for drinking water. And then finally, if you have an emergency, it's going to be there in case of an emergency. The web page again, jmccsci.com, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo. The mail order address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. The two things that I would have with me if I were in an emergency, flax and water. Those are the two basics that would get you through a long-term, say, disability. Let's call it that, a disability of Earth. Yep, I think I'm out of time here. My goodness, this goes fast. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night. And we'll see you next week, same time, same station.